This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 396 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today, we welcome an absolute legend of music and vinyl, Mr. Ed Cooper, who you may know as a founding member of the Saints, Laughing Clowns, and of course from his remarkable solo career. In 1976, Ed and his then bandmates released a fully band-funded DIY single, I'm Stranded, that to this day is credited with kicking off the punk movement. That I'm Stranded single was so powerful that people often put the Saints single and debut album alongside the Damned, Sex Pistols, and the Ramones debuts as the first and most highly influential bands of the era. And what makes this story even more remarkable is the Saints came from Brisbane, Australia, which at the time was not the burgeoning metropolis as it is today. The four of them recorded, then pressed this single, then mailed it to all parts of the world. It was an absolute Hail Mary pass that proved to be more powerful and influential than anyone expected, including Ed and the Saints themselves, which he discusses today. In today's chat, Ed talks all about the history of that single, how the Saints made the record, which is now extraordinarily collectible, the process of sending those records around the world, recollections of the various Saints releases, the upcoming box set, an alternate mix of the I'm Stranded album. We talk about Eternally Yours, Prehistoric Sounds, Laughing Clowns, Prince Melon Records, and of course, Ed's remarkable solo career, which is being celebrated with two new solo reissues, Electrical Storm and Honey Steals Gold. They're back on vinyl and streaming services, special colored vinyl pressings available at edcooper.com and remotecontrolrecords.com.au. Now, by the way, there is an extended version of this interview available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. More Ed, more details, more fun, and it's commercial-free and high-resolution audio. Plus, supporting us on Patreon helps support this show, and we finagle extra discounts and many extras for show patrons. So please, if you're not a patron already, make it happen now, patreon.com/vinylguide. And we thank you in advance for your support. And one final note, we have nearly 400 other interviews and episodes you can enjoy anytime simply by following the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app for free. Interviews with the likes of Jay Maskus of Dinosaur Jr., episode 393, Perry Farrell and Eric Avery of Jane's Addiction, episode 387, East Bay Ray of Dead Kennedys, episode 355, the Australian music legend himself, John Foy, episodes 340 and 341, another Australian powerhouse, Fifa Riccobono of Albert Productions, episode 338, and lots more. Enjoy hundreds of hours of vinyl and record nerdery talk with some of music's most legendary artists by simply following the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app. There we go. With the upfronts done, let's talk to music legend and DIY record pressing pioneer, Ed Cooper. Ed, here on the show, we talk about records, rare recordings, record collecting. Is it fair to say you're a record collector? Do you identify yourself as a record collector?
Well, I collect records. Yeah, I guess it's a, you know, it's a fairly broad term. Yes, I do collect records. Yeah.
In terms of your record, I assume you're listening to records every day, making time for them every week. Do you get much time to spend with them?
No. The COVID thing was actually good for that, because I actually got a chance to sit down and just listen to records for years, not years, hours a day, and which I hadn't done for years. So the records that I like to listen to are the ones that I've always kind of had. I don't necessarily, you know, need to have a thing that's been recorded in the digital era on vinyl, kind of thing, you know. So in that sense, I'm not a, you know,
you're not so much a format purist, but something that's recorded in the 70s that was originally intended for vinyl.
Yeah, I think so. That, you know, and I mean, a lot of the records that I've recorded myself were intended to come out as vinyl. Some of them didn't. So we're looking at addressing that, as well as reissuing some other things. But I think I derive a lot of pleasure out of listening to my old records and an album maybe that I hadn't heard that came out of that era. I kind of, you know, like to hear in that format, certainly.
So with these new reissues, Electrical Storm and Honey Steals Gold, it must be quite satisfying for you to, again, be presenting these in a vinyl format. Is that fair?
Yeah. It's satisfying to have remastered them. It's also satisfying to have them put out as CDs. The CDs sound better than ever before. I'm on the vinyl guide, so I suppose I should be addressing that that side of it. It's great. I love the look of them. I love the feel of them, you know. But I don't want to become sort of too sort of perverse about it, you know. I don't sleep with it or anything like that.
Right. Well, look, again, revisiting the music of your career and Electrical Storm, correct me if I'm wrong, that was originally released in 1985, and I think that was your first solo LP, is that right?
It was, yeah.
Okay. And I guess that was the first time you were stepping away from being in a band, you know. Was that a scary time? Was an exciting time for you? How was it going into making Electrical Storm?
It was really exciting. It was actually easier than having a band in a lot of ways because, you know, the last days of Laughing Clowns, the band had kind of, we weren't getting on very well. It was a depressing and hateful sort of atmosphere a lot of the time. So that it was great not dealing with that. It was great not sort of feeling that I had to kind of write so for something so people would be engaged. You know, everyone would be playing on every song. It kind of just gave me an opportunity to wipe the slate and start again, kind of thing.
Okay, so Electrical Storm, that consists of songs that you had written around 84, 85, that you didn't go back into the books to prior to that.
Not on that album. No, that album was probably all written between November of 84 and April of 85, I think.
All right. And Honey Steals Gold came out a few years later. I notice in this reissue sequence, you're skipping a couple albums, Rooms of the Magnificent, a few others. Mm. Are these albums you're going to eventually get to?
Yeah. Hopefully we're putting out everything that has been released, plus some things that haven't been released.
Oh, excellent.
In the process of going through all this material and seeing what we could actually kind of salvage, because the tapes, the artwork, everything had been very badly stored. And we actually found an unreleased album, so that's going to come.
Wow. And what era is that album from? 80s?
About 95, no, around Frontierland. So we're looking at maybe making Frontierland, you know, one of the new releases before the end of this year. Wow. And if that happens, we might do this other album, which I'm calling Mr. Miracle, which is going to be sort of like the sister album to Frontierland. They were done around the same time.
Wow. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about the tapes, because you said they hadn't been stored great, but they're still functional. You're able to bake them and use them.
Yeah. We had a little bit of problem with Electrical Storm, unfortunately. But so far everything else has been great. Okay. Luckily, you know.
Well, I know. Yeah, sometimes the heat in Brisbane isn't the greatest place to store.
Oh, was it? They weren't stored here. They were in Sydney.
Oh, okay. So you've got all the master tapes, all your solo stuff. You've got all the master tapes, or you know that they're where the master tapes are for Laughing Clowns. Okay. All right. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about a very rare record. I think you've you've probably seen one of these before.
I've probably even handled that very copy.
Oh, okay.
I was the storman at Fatal Records, so I handled most of them.
Okay. How did the band learn how to create a record? Was there a local band in Brisbane that had had their own 45 that you guys took a page out of or learned from?
No. I got the idea to that we could actually do this because I was working at Astor Records in Brisbane when I first left school. And one thing that I noticed there was that you had these individuals, usually like truck drivers who would be country and western singers that do a recording in a small studio, bring in a tape, and then, you know, a month later come back and they'd have their box of records waiting for them. And I thought, well, you know, if they could, you know, some guy singing Home on the Range or something for his mum can do it, then surely we can. And it proved to be a fairly straightforward process in itself. None of us had been in a studio before, but I just thought, well, you know, you go and record, get a tape, take it into a place and get it pressed. And that is exactly what happened.
Did the studio that you recorded I'm Stranded In, did they have connections to get the records pressed, or did you have to then find a press?
No, I just went back to Astor. And so I just dropped the tape off at the Brisbane office, paid them their $250 for a 500 pressing, 500 unit pressing, and came back, I think it was about 6 weeks later. And why I know this, they overpressed by around about, I think, 47 copies, which they charged me for, because I have the $23.50 receipt. So, it was an incredibly exciting experience. You know, I mean, as I say, we had no experience. No one had any knowledge, really, of what to do. We went into the studio. It was recorded and mixed in about 5 hours, I think, and came out. We didn't even have that was the last time we heard the song until we got the record. You know, we heard it in the studio. I don't even remember taking a cassette home. But when we got the record and then I put it on, that was just fucking brilliant. You know, it's just fantastic.
Now, I understand in the story of this, the tape that you sent away to get the records made was the only master tape of that recording. Mm. Now, for when it came to the album, was that a needle drop of a record that became?
Yeah.
Okay.
The album version is taken directly off one of those Fatal singles because the tape had gone missing.
Right.
It wasn't returned from a company in the UK. This is where my incredible naivety and ignorance, you know, I should have got it duped and sent them a duplicate, but, you know, I just thought, well, they're so keen on releasing the band, they have to be honest. I was, you know, I don't know, I was 20 years old. Seems quite naive for a person of that age in some ways, but there you go.
So the records were pressed in the UK, so they shipped them to the UK?
No. They were pressed here, but there were several pressings of this single. The Fatal pressing was done in Melbourne at the Astor pressing plant. Then where the tape got lost was when we sent it to a company in London, which is called
Power Exchange. Okay. How many records did you send around the world?
We got a copy to, you know, every magazine that I thought would do something, basically, which was all the UK weeklies, a couple of things in the US that I sort of heard about. There's Bump magazine and I can't remember what the other one was, Rock Scene or something might have been called. Mm-hmm. How many would I have sent out? I don't know, maybe up to 100, you know, like a fifth of the total pressing. I didn't keep a record.
Yeah. Thing, you know? So you got the boxes, 547 records, I think you said. Each of you took a box, and then I guess there was a communal box to just be shipped out. So you were in charge of shipping them around?
Yeah, I was both store manager and store man. I don't remember a lot of attendance from any of the other band members when it came to doing this stuff, but it might have happened. Yeah.
Right. It must have cost twice as much to ship them around the world as it did to actually get them pressed, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was sort of I was working. Ivor was working. Kim was working. I don't think Chris was. But it didn't really seem that much of an issue. We'd gone to the trouble of putting, a record out. I guess you just sort of assume that you're going to have to spend a bit on promotion, which in our case, sometimes a few stamps. The other thing that I should probably mention is that by the time the record came out, I was actually working in the public service, and I was able to sometimes use the postal resources of the Australian government.
That's okay. That record's repaid the export debts many times on that shipping, so that's okay.
Yeah.
I guess the plan for that record when you made it was, let's make this record, let's send it around, let's see what happens. What was the expectation of the band? What did you think was probably the likely scenario of what would happen through that process?
That a handful of people around the world would hear about us, buy the record directly from me, then work towards recording a second single. Mm-hmm. Would have been my, that. Not sort of taking into consideration that we got a really fantastic press response from the UK, which sort of really kick-started things over there. And here too, because there was no interest in the band in Australia. And I think at the point of release, my thought was, yeah, get it out, make people aware of the fact that we exist, and in a couple of months when we get some returns on the sales, record another song.
So that must have been very surreal when you started hearing the press feedback about the single and so many people getting excited about it. Yeah, what was that?
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird because we the first review that we saw was an Australian review for a magazine in Melbourne called Duke Magazine, and it was just a total slag off. It said this is probably the worst record you're ever going to hear in your life, sort of thing, which was great that it was so negative, but it was a really negative response. Then a few days later, a friend of mine got in touch. No one had phones. The places we lived in, no one actually had phones, and so if you wanted to give news to somebody sort of quick, you have to drive around or go around to their place. Anyway, a friend of mine came around, and he'd been listening to the ABC, and they had on the ABC news that this unknown Brisbane band had gotten, it was taking the UK by storm or something, and it was on the news. So we heard about this review that we got in the UK long before we actually saw it, weeks before. But people started getting in touch, so you get telegrams. That was a sort of speedy communication. I was getting telegrams sent to my mother's place because that was the sort of business address, because I wasn't sure where I'd be living at any given time. So you know, all these sort of urgently call us, where can we call you kind of thing. And I, you know, didn't have a phone. No one in the band had a phone. So I got these piles of telegrams of all this desperate communication from mainly from the UK, you know, people buying to, it was kind of like, mm-hmm. there was no way that we could sort of process the information in a kind of sensible way. Unfortunately, it was just, you know, it's all a bit unreal.
So one of those telegrams, I imagine, was from that Power Exchange record label.
Mm.
There was a Power Exchange version of that single, not only in the UK, but also Canada and a few other territories. Can you recall like the breadth of what that agreement was with Power Exchange?
It was pretty loose and pretty open to interpretation, is all I can remember without looking back on it directly, sort of thing. You know, I mean, even the first, you know, the contract signed in those days wouldn't stand today. It's just the fact that they were all done back then, and it's sort of hard to, you know, backtrack that. I mean, the contract that the Saints signed with EMI wouldn't stand today. I mean, it's a ridiculous contract, full of holes. Both, you know, giving them everything, but also enough holes in it. If we had have had an experienced sort of opinion at the time, we could. This is a joke. You don't owe them anything, you know. But yeah, different times.
So the Power Exchange was just, that was just a one-off just for the single, and then EMI came in and just took it all on. You recently on social media teased a bit about a test pressing for I'm Stranded. So I assume at some point in the next year or so, we'll see a proper reissue of that and possibly other Saints material.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
You recently on social media teased a bit about a test pressing for I'm Stranded. So I assume at some point in the next year or so, we'll see a proper reissue of that and possibly other Saints material.
Yeah, we have this plan to. In fact, with the 2nd of August 1976 is when we've now kind of narrowed that down to being the release date of I'm Stranded, because that's when I picked the copies up from Astor Records in Brisbane.
Okay,
and that's the date on my receipt. So we, on the 2nd of August this year, we are reissuing the single in all its international covers. On a label called In the Red.
Oh, okay.
So that's coming out in about four or five different covers. I'm not sure if the vinyl is colored, but you know, for people that I know that's a thing with some people. And also excitingly, I suppose we're looking at doing a box set of the first album and include the alternate mix. It'll be a four LP box set with a booklet, a book-ish thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's going to follow. I'm not sure when. That'll either be later this year, early next year. I'm not sure about that. But the the single is due for August of this year.
Wow. All right. So I imagine there's quite a few outtakes or songs that were recorded around the same time that could be included. Like there was the EP, the 1, 2, 3, 4 EP, which had a couple of covers on it, I believe. That could
yeah,
be
we got that. That'll be on it. There's the, you know, there's the single, the 12-inch single of This Perfect Day, which is a completely different recording to the one that was on the second album. That the B-sides of that, there's some live at Paddington Town Hall in Sydney. Then there's also the full live at the Hope and Anchor in London. But I think the most interesting thing for me is the alternate version of the first album. The mixes are different. Set running order is slightly different. Well, song list is slightly different. And it's a different experience. Whether you prefer it to the first album that was released or not is not kind of the issue. But I think people that really... It will allow you to hear the first album differently. The mixes are different.
So there was an alternate mix, an alternate version back in the day that was
compiled. Yeah. It's not something that it's not like me going back and remixing the first album. Right. This is the version that was originally mixed without the band involvement. And when I heard it, it didn't do what I thought it should do. So Bailey and I went to Sydney and we remixed it really quickly. And you know, when you say you remix something these days, it's sort of like, you add it for a month or something like that. I mean, I think we were there for 2 days and we remixed the album. And, you know, the actual release version is more faithful to what I wanted at the time. The unreleased version is maybe a more conventional mix, but because it's a much wider stereo, which I didn't like, you know, I wanted to me whenever, you know, my only really experience of the band was either mono recordings that I was doing on my mono cassette deck, or the way it sounded to me when I was standing in front of my amp. So that was the sound that I was wanting, and that's what you kind of get on the released version. The unreleased version, which was mixed by Rod Coe and an engineer, it's really good, actually, listening back to it now, but it's really different to my mind. You know, I've played it to some people, and they kind of think it's night and day. Other people think, well, you know, I can't really hear that much of a difference. But because it does focus on the stereo, you kind of have to listen to it, you know, attentively kind of thing. You can't put it on in the background and go make sandwiches in the kitchen or something, because then you won't get the stereo effect. But it's great. I think, you know, we've got some really good things in the booklet. Some of the telegrams that I've been discussing, reviews and fanzine stuff, and there's some good stuff there.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah, there's been some very well known albums that have had these alternate versions come out. Like the Stooges had the John Cale mix come out in the last few years. Something done back in the day that was rejected. So it'd be an interesting view into that album. The cover of that album, I understand that picture was taken in a squat house in Sydney. Is that right?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was taken in down the road from where the band had our Club 76 sort of headquarters. It was sort of this building on the corner of Petra Terrace and Milton Road in Brisbane. It's still standing, actually. We did a the story of the cover is sort of, once again, one of those fairly convoluted things. I always hated that cover. I didn't approve that cover. We did a series of photos with a photographer in Brisbane, who has kind of very generously actually passed on these photographs, and we're going to be using them in the box set. Anyway, we had these locations and discussed where we wanted things to be done, and so we did these really, really great black and white photographs. And then EMI got in touch and said, "Oh, you know, like these aren't really quite professional enough, or something." I can't remember what the reason was. And they sent up some photographer who then basically tried to copy all the ideas that we'd put down. And just did it in this really fucking, advertising agency. The photos on the first Saints album have got that hazy sort of, I don't know if it's Vaseline coated lens kind of look, which it's also completely warped. The actual photograph, it makes, I'm taller than Chris.
Oh, yeah.
So there's something really weird about the whole thing. Anyway, I hate it. But, you know, that in itself, you know, it's become whatever it is. But the actual idea for the front cover, which I had, is vastly superior. And so we're using that in the box set sort of thing, because this is, you know, a completely separate thing. We're including the original cover, but as part of the advertising campaign, the EMI did this really shitty, really daggy, you know, the Saints Unstranded has not been released. It's escaped or something like that. It's just the daggiest fucking promo campaign. But we've got one of those posters and we'll probably do a repro of that and include it in the box kind of thing. So, it gets referenced. It's part of the story. I'll tell you the funny. I think Ivor, the Saints drummer, approved that. I wasn't in Sydney when that. I must have been off having a fight with my girlfriend or something like that. So, Ivor approved it. And if you look at the cover, you can see, like, there he is. He looks like, you know, some A grade hustler from some Andy Warhol 70s film or something like that. So he's quite happy with the way he's like it. But else looks really fucking weird. There's some sort of, you know, just lens distortion or something. I can't work it out.
Okay.
So Kim was not that fat. I was not that short, and Bailey was not that big.
But Ivor liked the picture, so that's what.
Yeah, Ivor was quite happy with it. Yeah. Well, he used to hang out in the EMI offices all the time. You know, like he'd always be flirting with all the secretaries and things. So he was always in there.
So is there going to be a similar treatment to Prehistoric Sounds or?
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully we're doing the other two as well.
Right. Do you still look back on that period, those three records, with a lot of pride? Do you look back on them as maybe some frustration or things you would want to do different? How do you reflect back on those?
Musically, I'm really proud of them. I there would be a couple of things that I'd do a little bit differently. I would have been aware of something remixing the first album that I wasn't aware of at the time and didn't really pick up on, but which I won't draw attention to. It's just a good, I will actually, it goes out. There's a little bit of a phasing issue. It was part of my trying to make it more mono thing, which resulted in not quite as much bass on that as I think it should have. The first mix has more bass, which is the one that we rejected. But I think we were mixing so loud that didn't hear the fact that it didn't have that much bass.
Right.
And when you really mix, you know, and keeping in mind also that none of us had even like halfway decent stereo. So when you go into a studio and hear studio monitors, it was like, wow, you know, it's just the most amazing thing that's ever been recorded. And especially if you crank it up kind of thing. So, little bits and pieces, but generally, no, I'm really happy with them. You know, they were what I was aiming for. If they fell flat, then that was all part of the process. No, I really like those records. I always have.
Just going back to the single really quick, who thought of the name, or what's the background of the name Fatal Records?
It's sort of a little play on KTEL, which is probably not very obvious. I mean, I was thinking for a little while that we might sort of call it Fatel, you know, but that got lost in translation to Astor, and so it came out as Fatal, which is okay.
Oh, okay. And I love how some of the more recent records that you've released, the Aints, you still incorporate Fatal Records.
Yeah,
part of that.
Well, I started the label. I mean, it was the band's label, but it was my idea to do it.
So after Saints, you formed Laughing Clowns, and as part of that, there was Prince Melon Records.
Mm.
Can you walk us through a brief history of Prince Melon? That a label that you started alone? Was that with Ken West? How did that come together?
Came about after the Clowns did their first recording with Missing Link Records, which is a Melbourne label run by Keith Glass. And it was after doing that I decided that I think I'd rather do it myself. There were just sort of a few things that kind of went askew, just decisions taken about things. Not the recording, but with the cover and you know, just the pricing. There were a few sort of minor disagreements with Keith. And he was actually wanting something quite different anyway. I remember when we were recording the mini album or album, but Keith came into the studio and he was sort of looking quite troubled. I think he was sort of hoping that my new band would be like a new version of the Saints or something. And, but it was a funny kind of thing, him being there. He brought his daughter in, who I don't remember how old she was, probably about 12 or something. And he asked her what she thought of the music and she said it was great. So I thought, well, fuck you, Keith. Your daughter knows. But anyway. Anyway, so yeah, we kind of got out of that. And then I just thought, well, you know, I've done my own record before. Let's just do that with the Clowns. And that's what we did. Ken West was involved in it. He didn't set it up or anything. Ken did a lot of work when he was working with the Clowns. And, you know, well, it was sort of a shame that we had a falling out. But fallout we did. And but yeah, that was just done. You know, Ken and I would drive out to Parramatta and drop off 50 records at, you know, whatever the music shop out there was, you know, that sort of thing. It was all very hands-on. And yeah, just done in a similar sort of way to the way that the Saints had been done. Except by that time, of course, you know, independent records weren't quite the novelty that they were 5 years earlier or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm Stranded seems to have really kicked off a lot of bands, empowering a lot of bands to think, wow, I could do this myself. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's been all over the place, a very DIY kind of approach, which has also inspired a lot of labels, you know, out of the U.S., Discord, and Epitaph directly cite what you and the Saints did as, wow, this is something that
Why do we need to wait for someone to give us permission and money? We could do it ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it was a great explosion of stuff, you know. I mean, and these days it's even more sort of easy to kind of get your stuff out. But yeah, in those days it was sort of quite a lot of work involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, the I'm Stranded singles, very collectible. Are you aware of what they typically go for on the collector's market?
I don't. I had a look at Discogs some time ago. Prices are sort of, you know, anywhere from like a grand to a few grand, mm-hmm. depending on the condition. And I mean, yeah.
Does that shock you?
It shocks me that it isn't more in some ways, because I actually know how rare it is. You know, like when, but it, I think it would be more if it was not, you know, I mean, it's such an easily available song these days. You know, it's on, you know, it's on YouTube, you know, you can access all this stuff. So in, I think if it was a more, restricted sort of market, you know, the way it was pre-internet days, I think it would probably be worth more. It is a really rare record. And you look at any of those records from that era, there's some quite high prices, but on the face of it. But then when you think, well, you know, there's only so many of these things exist, they're sort of, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not that crazy is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, people can get the music and people can certainly enjoy it. And it's
I think you have to love to have the actual artifact, you know, and I can understand that sort of collecting. I think, you know, I do that a little bit. If it's something that means something to me, I want a specific issue of it, sort of thing. That's not true for most records, but you know, there are certain things that are important in that sort of way.
So is the plan now to be focusing on a lot of these reissues? Because you've got the two out, Electrical Storm, Honey Steals Gold. I'll give the URL edcooper.com or remotecontrolrecords.com.au. I'll put those in the episode page. These are just the first of many sort of reissues, revisitations of your work, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We've got one album here. That's Character Assassination.
Yeah.
Which I think was on vinyl. There's only one pressing of it from Europe. White vinyl. And let me know.
You're right. That in fact, that album is we went to a lot of trouble cutting that. And it is a 100% analog production. Mm-hmm. We even found a cutting house in London which still used analog pre-delay as opposed to digital pre-delay, which is what everyone, you know, all the big places like Abbey Road, etc., all using digital pre-delay, but we wanted to go 100% analog. So I can't remember the name of the place, but it's on the record there somewhere. So yeah, those records, if you are sort of a vinyl analog, you know, like a real purist, that record is a good one. You know, I sort of encouraged that we look to sort of do it properly, because that came out, the album just before it, Serene Machine, didn't even get a vinyl release because CDs had sort of really taken over by that time. And in Australia especially, EMI had sold off their cutting lathe, I think. There's something ridiculous. They'd spent $100,000 to kind of bring it, sort of modernize it. Mm-hmm. And then the head office decided that, well, vinyl is dead. So I think they sold it for $5,000 to some place in Korea after having just spent $100,000 on it.
Yeah.
That's why they can't afford to pay you royalties. Yeah. Like this. Idiotic business decisions.
When Saints were signed to EMI, and living in the UK, that was around the same time that this whole Sex Pistols EMI thing came up. Was there any blowback or impact to the Saints from that Sex Pistols?
Yeah, probably a little bit. Yeah, I reckon maybe that some of the kind of more naive and sort of scenes type punks thought we might have been some sort of class traitors or something. You know, there seemed to be this thing that, yeah, I don't know. There was a little bit, not that much. I mean, we were actually on Harvest in the UK, so which was a sort of a sub-label of EMI. Harvest used to be their progressive rock label in the early 70s, and so it was sort of an odd kind of – I was quite happy to be on Harvest, actually. I quite liked it as a label.
Okay, because, yeah, I always saw Harvest as a little bit – like you say, prog rock. It seemed like a mismatch, but
yeah. The funny thing was that, well, initially it was great. I'm trying to remember his name. Nick Mobbs. I think was the head of A&R when we signed. He was great. He was really enthusiastic. The thing that, of course, you know, with our lack of experience, that we weren't kind of expecting was that 3 months later, Nick Mobbs would be fired, or I can't remember if he got fired or if he quit. Anyway, then there was a new A&R man. So I can't remember his name, but we still had a sort of fairly good. We had about three or four changes, and by the time the fourth change came around, there wasn't any. You know, these people get their jobs because they bring something new, and if you know you've been brought to the label by someone else, that you don't really quite get the attention that maybe you should. But that was sort of, you know, in the company itself. Initially, it was good. You know, the staff in the London office were really good.
Mm-hmm.
Initially. But quick turnover.
The story I heard was Prehistoric Sounds had some difficulty getting approved for release. Is that true, or was it?
No, not really. There was sort of like this, an intervention, and like by the time we were recording Prehistoric Sounds, the band was, you know, we all knew pretty much that this was going to be our last record, and initially there was I think the label was a bit shocked by the record. I think they were expecting something completely different. We made the mistake of having just been mucking about in the sort of getting the sounds right. It recorded an Otis Redding song called Security, and someone at EMI heard that and just thought, oh, well, this is great. Put that out. I didn't even want it to be on the album, but I thought, we're not going to be around to tour this album. I want it to come out. And so having an extra song added was not a major, like a disgusting kind of compromise, even though I think it unbalances the second side. A lot of people like it, you know, I don't, but you know, that was sort of the extent of it. It wasn't really that hard to put out. They weren't that resistant. We had, to put it into perspective, Eternally Yours, the second album, was released in February of 78. We toured that album. We broke up, got back together to record the third album, which started in April, finished in May. The album was out in September. Doesn't sound like a rough ride to me, kind of thing. You know, we're sort of six months between the second and third album, sort of thing.
Right.
I think if the band had have had, we probably needed like completely different management by that time. And I think if there weren't sort of like Chris and I weren't getting on all that well at that stage. We'd been really good friends up until that time, and kind of drifted apart a little bit around then. I think some of that was sort of artistically driven, which then turned into sort of a bit of an ego clash kind of thing. But, you know, for all, Chris didn't like prehistoric sounds. Keeping that in mind, I think his performance on it is fantastic. You know, like you would get no inkling of it, but he didn't enjoy the process, and he often criticized the album in years to follow. But I thought it was a brilliant performance of his, and I think, you know, before he died, I think he actually came to realize that it was a fucking lot better than he'd given it credit for, sort of thing. So that was good. But no, I think, you know, the band could have gone on. I mean, you know, we had interest from EG Records after Prehistoric Sounds, probably because they were sort of thinking, oh, this band is actually not, you know, what the first album would, you know, there's kind of a depth and a broadness to this band, which, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Prehistoric Sounds and Eternally Yours are just such a great fit on the Harvest label. I think that, you know, I like the design of the label, and you know, for the most part, people were pretty good. You know, they just weren't around that long.
Now, I know Saints were signed to Sire Records in the U.S. Did the Saints tour the U.S.?
No. I can't even remember how Seymour Stein got to hear it. I wouldn't have sent him a record, but anyway, he was Seymour Stein was an early enthusiast, promised all, didn't really deliver though.
Okay. Yeah,
we had the first two albums, Stranded and Eternally Yours, were released in the U.S. Prehistoric Sounds wasn't.
Were there overages to tour the U.S. back in the day?
Yeah, no, we were definitely intending to. I mean, I remember going to the American Embassy, you know, getting our passport, our visa stamps and stuff, but it didn't happen. Remember that the time between the recording of the first Saints album, which was in October in 76, and the recording of Prehistoric Sounds, it's like 18 months. We did three albums, we did the tours. There wasn't like a lot of time that we weren't doing things. And by the time we could have toured the States or could have even come back to Australia, because we didn't come back to Australia and tour again after we left either, you know, that would have been in the future. It just wasn't enough time to sort of do all those things. We toured, we did a Europe, or did a few shows in, wasn't actually a European tour. We played in Holland, we played in France,
So back to the reissues. In terms of your solo work, or really work with any of the bands, are there any of the master tapes that are missing and unaccounted for? Anything that is difficult to reissue?
Look, I haven't been through everything, so I don't know. I know that there is an issue with one of the Clowns albums, at least. I'm not quite sure how we're going to get around that yet. I think most of the solo stuff we've now got together, and it's sort of in order. There's a lot of it, and there's a lot of things that didn't sort of make it onto albums. So,
right.
You know, I haven't been through all that. It's just too difficult to find the time.
Right.
Plus, I don't have a 24-track machine to kind of just chuck a tape on anytime I feel like it.
All right. So, Ed, again, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide and being patient with our record nerd questions and helping us collect some of these facts, because, you know how weird we are with stacks.
You didn't even start on my Yellow Fontana label collection. So.
Oh, no way. Okay. All right. What the Yellow Fontana. Okay. That's going to have to be another day, because I know how how precious those are. Do you have a Black Sabbath first pressing on Yellow Fontana?
I don't. I have the one that I bought it in the time, which was the blue one that followed it. Oh, but it's my copy. My copy that I bought in, you know, early 1971, sort of thing. So it is the copy for me. I don't actually think I've seen one of the. I have the other ones. You know, they're seven Vertigo records.
Yeah,
and they're all. I have each of those on the Yellow Fontana, but not the Black Sabbath.
Okay.
That was probably the biggest seller. The others probably didn't sell. You know, you had Manfred Mann and Rod Stewart, who was unknown, and Chrysler. Can't remember them, but you know the ones.
We'll have to have a proper record nerd conversation again at some point.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So everyone, make sure you check out Ed's recent reissues, Electrical Storm, Honey Steals Gold, both on Remote Control Records. They're available Friday, June 9th. I believe Electrical Storm is already on streaming services. Honey Steals Gold, I think, is coming out on June 9th on streaming. So there are a couple tracks out there. Check them out, listen to them, and then set yourself up to download the entire album or have it downloaded when it's released in early June. You can order vinyl copies, and there's a couple of special colors and pressings at edcooper.com or remotecontrolrecords.com.au. And keep an eye out for further Ed Cooper reissues, including, sounds like, the Saints I'm Stranded box set that's coming out that has really got me salivating. Ed, again, absolute honor to have you on the show, and look forward to not only your further reissues, but seeing you hopefully live in Sydney, or if I get up north to Brisbane, hopefully we can connect and we'll do some more record nerd chit-chat.
Okay. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh man, I've always wanted to have Ed on the show, and I got to have him back. I think we only kind of just scratched the surface. We focused on that first Saint single, which is an incredible story, and I wanted to focus on it, but there's a lot of other areas of Ed's career we can talk about. Maybe a deep dive into the Laughing Clown someday, and his solo releases. I can see a few other episodes with Ed coming up in the future. I hope we can make them happen. Again, in the meantime, check out Ed's reissues of Electrical Storm and Honey Steals Gold on Remote Control Records, available at edcooper.com or remotecontrolrecords.com.au. All that music is available on streaming services, so if you have Apple or Spotify, you could check out some songs now or set yourself up for the full download of the album when it's available. And don't forget, we've got an extended and commercial-free and high-resolution audio version of this interview available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the show and enjoy all the extras. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, put them up in the Reddit forums or the Facebook groups. Show your record nerd friends how to get a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.